From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings, the history and criticism of art. Those are the topics this week on Soundings. My guests are two scholars who have completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center, Rona Goffin of Duke University and Michael Shapiro of the St. Louis Art Museum. First on this edition of Soundings, a conversation with Rona Goffin about the life and work of the Italian Renaissance painter Giovanni Bellini. Following that, a discussion with Michael Shapiro about contemporary views of art and its critics. Rona Goffin is the author of Piety and Patronage in Renaissance Venice, published by Yale University Press in 1986. She's also the author of Giovanni Bellini, scheduled for publication by the Yale Press in 1988. Rona Goffin, you're at the Humanities Center from Duke University. You're an art historian, and you're writing about Giovanni Bellini. This is an Italian, that is to say, a Venetian painter. Why is this man important in the history of art of painting?
I'll answer you by making a bet. I'd bet you a nickel that you wouldn't ask me that question if it were, say, Titian or Leonardo da Vinci.
Names that people more or less recognize.
Right.
Okay.
But in point of fact, aside from being Titian's teacher, Bellini was certainly his equal and indeed one of the greatest masters of Western art.
How do you measure these things? Give me a few generalities about that before we come to some specifics.
That's hard. In part, I suppose the real answer is that the proof is in the pudding, or in this case, the proof is in the looking. And that, of course, we can't do on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
But even during his lifetime, and indeed ever since, Bellini was always recognized as one of the greatest masters of the art of painting, not only by compatriots, that is, other Venetians, other Italians, but also by other Europeans. Mm-hmm. For example, Albrecht Dürer, who came to Venice from Germany toward the end of Bellini's life in the early 16th century, wrote back home saying, Bellini is very old, but he's still the greatest painter.
Hmm.
And part of the problem of dealing with Bellini is to explain how it is that he seems to have been eclipsed, as it were, admired as a god during his lifetime,
goodness,
venerated also by Titian, who was not very nice to other people, and certainly very envious of the accomplishments of other painters, nonetheless venerated by Titian and acknowledged by him in a very moving last work, which Titian had meant for his own tomb. But essentially, much more important than that, is an ability to express ideas in a compelling way, in a convincing way. The same would be true if one were asked, why is Shakespeare great? Because in addition to belonging so obviously to his time, which is not, in fact, so far from Bellini's time, a master like Shakespeare or like Bellini or like Titian transcends his time and seems relevant to us regardless how many centuries separate us from him.
We're talking about universality.
We're talking about universality and I think, ongoing human truths, which are relevant even if you are not a believing Catholic worshiping in front of a Bellini Madonna.
Tell me, be specific for me, Rona Goffin. You mentioned Giovanni Bellini's ideas. What is it that helps us to recognize the greatness of this painter?
If one, for example, were looking at some of his portraits, maybe one would pick the most famous of these, the portrait of one of the rulers of Venice, Doge Leonardo Loredan, portrait now in London. You would say, I think, and probably anyone who saw it would say, that is the kind of man you would like to have ruling you.
Hmm.
It's a fairly simple image in that it's only a bust-length portrait. You don't even see the man's hands. He's not necessarily doing anything. But somehow Bellini, by the modeling of the features, by the manipulation of light and shade and patterns, even details of the garment that suggest movement, even though the man himself is still, in a way energizing him while yet achieving the monumentality and grandeur you get from stasis.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things reflected in the face with a kind of intelligence, possibility of humor, but nothing frivolous, compassion, seriousness of purpose, all of these things show in that face and make him an ideal ruler, not only for Venice, but for anyone, mm-hmm. elected or hereditary, what you will. Now, when Venetians, and again, I mean patricians, the ruling class, because—
The patrons. Right.
Exceptionally very rich merchant class individuals, but essentially the patricians. This was a group of people who defined themselves already in the late 12th and early 13th century. What they did was this. It would be as though members of the Senate said to themselves, folks, we are now the fathers of the future ruling class of the United States, mm-hmm. and only people who are a direct legitimate descendants will be eligible to hold government office. Only our direct descendants, and of course in the Renaissance this meant male descendants,
right.
could hold office, that is to say, could wield power. Concomitant with that, by the way, not so coincidentally, was only that group had access, therefore, to major money. That's how you became rich.
Mm-hmm.
You could give yourselves or protect monopolies of trade, for example. Well, this group is Bellini's clientele. And this group, when they studied the classics, were interested in learning how to read Greek and Latin, for example, primarily because that enabled them to carry on trade better with their colonies in the East. Or it enabled them to read ancient political tracts with which they could buttress their own arguments defending the regime.
Mm-hmm. Does it have anything to do with human behavior? That is to say, with the way these patricians conducted their lives? I get the sense
it
that they're setting themselves up as models for future generations.
Absolutely, and that mostly comes through in the portraits that are painted of them.
Mm-hmm.
Portraits in which emotion and anything transient is purposefully suppressed.
Mm-hmm.
Not only by Bellini and his art, but indeed by the patricians and their behavior, or at least that was the ideal.
Socializing people. Is that a fair word to apply?
Yes,
here?
In a sense, yes. Patricians, for example, are always exhorting each other to suppress feelings, even if patrician women are allowed, for example, to weep when their parents die.
Right.
They should be consoled and encouraged to put conspicuous sorrowing behind them. It's simply not considered appropriate.
What does this word Venetians, or your term, Ronogoffin, Venetian spirituality, how does that bear on a society that, as you just said, suppresses feeling? Help me with that a little bit.
Or suppresses
are we talking
the expression
about
of emotions.
Extravagance in emotion?
Well, extravagance is something else again. They were capable of great extravagance in behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Famous parties were given throughout the century and a half that interests me most of all in Venice. Great cavorting was carried on in the canals. But that's a very different matter from giving vent to your emotions. It's one thing to have fun. It's one thing to paint your gondola a fabulous color instead of the black that was legislated as the only proper color. One thing to wear more jewelry than the sumptuary laws said you should,
mm-hmm.
or even to have more marzipan in your wedding cake, something else that the sumptuary laws tried to legislate and forbid. It's something else to allow individual feelings to get in the way of your purpose in life, if you're a Venetian patrician, which is to perpetuate the regime.
Mm-hmm. So spirituality here doesn't necessarily have anything to do with religion? Or
No. It has everything to do with religion.
Okay.
I was answering the other part of your question.
All right.
Spirituality, just as the Venetians might study Greek because they had considerable holdings in the East, they also had deep-seated spiritual and emotional ties, if I can use that word again in a different way, to the East. The Venetian state had, in fact, been founded as a satellite, as it were, a kind of military outpost of the Byzantine Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And for the Venetians, even centuries after they had reversed that initial relationship and had become masters of the peoples who had been their first rulers, even so, for the Venetians, the Byzantine East was sacrosanct in a way that quite distinguishes them from other Italian city-states. the Florentines, for example, or the Romans, for that matter, when they imagined themselves going through a rebirth of culture and spirit and accomplishment, a reassertion of the glories that had been typical of the ancient world and which supposedly had been shrouded in darkness during the Middle Ages.
Right.
These are all, by the way, the kinds of terms that Petrarch would have used, for instance, to describe the Renaissance. When Romans or Florentines imagined this rebirth, they turned toward ancient Rome as their great model. The Venetians looked towards ancient Greece.
Mm-hmm.
And their spirituality, to get to your question, likewise was colored by the Byzantine approach towards Christ and the saints. That for the Venetians, Christianity as practiced in the East,
mm-hmm.
Was a great example of faith.
Uh-huh.
And this meant that when the Venetians, and greatest among them Bellini in my period, when the Venetians visualized their beliefs, they tended to turn towards the models of Byzantine art.
Mm-hmm.
To continue these and to repeat them long after they would have been considered outmoded elsewhere. Unlike the Byzantines who inspired him, however, mm-hmm. Bellini did not merely repeat over and over again the same formulas. They are remarkable for their variety.
He's original, in other words, rather as much as synthetic.
Yes, while evoking this splendid, glorious, and very sacred tradition, he
yeah.
also varied it, and
mm-hmm.
with the most remarkable inventiveness,
mm-hmm.
so that each of these images has about it a kind of uniqueness that makes one feel that his relationship to the sacred image is very personal and very particular.
Mm-hmm. Rona Goffin, we're talking about your work here at the Humanities Center regarding Giovanni Bellini, a Venetian painter who lives, you've told me, roughly from 1400 through about the beginning of the 16th century.
A little later. Born about 1432 and died 1516.
What kind of spin are you putting on your work here at the center about this man?
What's a spin?
Well, what I'm asking you is a sort of big so what question. Why are you writing a book about Bellini? What's the big deal? What are you doing that hasn't necessarily been done before?
I hope I'm giving him his due.
Uh-huh.
He is, and I think most art historians would agree with this, certainly one of the greatest painters who ever wielded a brush. But he, I think, has been given short shrift. And this downplaying or failure to recognize his historical importance, which is nothing less than the establishment of the High Renaissance in Italy,
mm-hmm.
This has generally not been recognized, in part because our perceptions of the High Italy in Renaissance were determined for us by people writing with a very partisan point of view already in the 16th century, and for other reasons as well. And in part, too, because Bellini suffers from his very great success. He must have been one of the most successful artist businessmen, if you like, of the 15th and early 16th century.
Well, you mentioned the comfortable relationship between him and his patrons.
Not only that, not only did he enjoy the support of the Venetian ruling class, both as individuals and in terms of government commissions, but he clearly employed what must have been one of the largest groups of studio assistants ever assembled under one shop roof. Because in addition to works that are certainly by him, judging from the quality of the handling of the paint and from the originality of the conceptions, in addition to these, there are innumerable studio replicas, variants, works done perhaps under his direction or perhaps merely reflecting his influence, which was immense.
Mm-hmm. He was a one-man industry, it sounds like.
He was a one-man industry.
Uh-huh.
And I can't even give you a rough figure. I'd guess perhaps, off the top of my head, close to 500 paintings survive, and this must be only a fraction of what would have been painted,
mm-hmm.
because we're talking about 500 years of loss, after all.
Mm-hmm.
Something like 500 pictures survive which belong to his ambit.
Mm-hmm.
Of these, maybe 100 are by him.
Mm-hmm.
However, this clearly testifies to an extraordinary success, which I think must have been almost unequaled.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes him, in turn, this very success, difficult to study, because you've got to weed away all the chaff to get to the good stuff. You've got to see him through all these layers of replicas and variants and shopworks. You've got to strip away the excess. And that's not so easy to do always. Then, too, one is faced with the difficulties of working with material that's 500 years old, which never survives intact, ever, which will have been badly restored, mucked about, scraped, abraded, repainted.
Goodness.
So that a lot of this has to do with reconstruction. Mm-hmm. The so what question, well, I think he's important to us today or any day because he gave beautiful and sometimes even sublime expression to basic human concerns. Mm. And that, I believe, is true whether or not one is a Catholic, as Bellini was and as his patrons were, whether or not one is Italian or Venetian or believes in a regime ruled by an oligarchy. I'm not talking about these, which are circumstances having to do with his particular situation, his historical context, but rather the underlying truths that he expresses. Ideals about our relationship to God, mm-hmm. Our relationships to each other, our hopes and our standards, both moral and intellectual standards. These things he visualizes, and by visualizing them, he makes them more powerful still than perhaps any text can do, because his images convince us and help us form our thoughts in a way that nothing one reads, nothing one hears, quite can do with the same compelling force. I think in the end, one's ideas are formed as much by images as anything verbal. Ancient people knew this. Renaissance people knew this. Images were always regarded, quite rightly, as magical. Mm-hmm. And we're learning it again today when we complain about, for example, the force television has in our lives.
Indeed.
It's still true. It was always true. We should be on TV now. And then we could show Bellini pictures and make it patently true about him for your audience. But at any rate, when he visualizes these ideals, these hopes and aspirations of human beings, regardless of their particular social or political or historical circumstances, I believe in a very real way that he helps make us better people. Looking at works by him, we elevate ourselves. We aspire to the model that he visualizes for us and makes concrete and visible for us.
Rona Goffin is a professor at Duke University. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, she worked on a forthcoming study about the life and work of the Italian Renaissance painter Giovanni Bellini. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on the History and Criticism of Art continues now with a discussion featuring Michael Shapiro of the St. Louis Art Museum. During his fellowship year at the center, Michael Shapiro worked on a study of marble carving and American sculpture. Michael Shapiro is currently at work on a forthcoming monograph about the mid-19th century American portrait and genre painter George Caleb Bingham. Michael Shapiro, you're a curator at the St. Louis Art Museum. What is new in American art in terms of what gets picked to be put on display, the sense of art on the part of the curators and the museums?
Well, in the area of special exhibitions, in recent years, some of the most creative thinking and rethinking of American painting has been formulated in the areas of special exhibitions. And museum exhibitions and the catalogs that accompany them represent, as you suggested, changing views of certain artists and themes which were previously thought to be beyond the pale.
Well, now, what does this represent? I mean, I suppose we could call this revisionism of a sort. Are we looking at what might be analogous in the literary movement, which is to say the inclusion of work by women or blacks, or if not on the basis of gender or social position, on the basis of the subject of the art, that sort of thing? Help me with that.
Well, there are certain subjects which were previously considered to be trivial or anathema to high art that are now being embraced or unfolded within these new viewpoints.
Like, and give me an example.
Let me give you two or three examples from the area of really turn of the century, late 19th and early 20th century American painting and sculpture. For example, the art of Frederick Remington, an Easterner who painted and sculpted Western themes, had been until recently looked down upon.
Why? It was too popular? It was...
Well, he is a victim of his own popular success, and in a sense was persecuted by it. But it was in part the subject matter that people believed that paintings of cowboys and Indians couldn't have the same content that a landscape painting might have.
It didn't have anything to do with technical ability so much as it did subject.
It was really people saw... Certain people saw the subject, certain and couldn't get past it. Now the innovations in painting that Remington affected, his ability to create these unusual cantilevered bronzes and bronze sculptures, which barely support themselves and hardly touch the ground. His innovations with the bases and the patinas of his sculptures, his ability to create such tremendous energy in his paintings, is being seen with fresh eyes.
Why was it rejected earlier? You talked about what the sort of high art, low art polarity, and I get the sense that that you think of that as an unnecessary polarity, one that has been created. Can we use a word like the snobs to get right down to it?
I think there are those social inhibitors that that are being broken down at present. But I think there is a parallel between contemporary American painting and this fresh view of older American art. At present, there is a sense of pluralism, that there that there are many ways up the mountain, and that there are many artists working in a variety of representational or abstract or modes which combine abstract and figural techniques. And I think that that is giving most Americanists a kind of open mind to other a less formalist and less strict approach to what makes great art.
What's going on now at the St. Louis Art Museum, Michael Shapiro, that represents this fresh look at what the historical, at our American artistic inheritance?
Well, there are at least three exhibitions that we're three to four exhibitions that we're working on that reflect some of these changes. One exhibition that opens at the end of August is a Louis Sullivan exhibition called The Function of Ornament, and it attempts to right a kind of critical wrong, which is saying that not only is he the father of the skyscraper, form follows function, but he also evolved out of a Beaux-Arts tradition of ornamentation of his works, which also continued on by his former student, Frank Lloyd Wright. So that's a new interpretation of architecture. Then we have an exhibition of a private collection from St. Louis of 20th century American art that dates between the two world wars. And that, too, is innovative. It's the Barney Ebsworth collection and reflects a lot of big names like Hopper or Georgia O'Keeffe or Charles Sheeler, for example, but there are also a lot of lesser names, Esfer Slobodkina, Ilya Bolotovsky, all kinds of, Jan Matulka.
Unknown names.
Relatively unknown names. Yeah. And that is also opening the door to give a not only a flavor of the period, mm-hmm. but a recognition for people who were talented and were forgotten.
Final question, Michael Shapiro. You come from the St. Louis Art Museum. Is the reconsideration of American art that you have been describing, does that exist, what, solely on the part of the curators and the people who own the paintings and the people who run the museums? Is it in any sense a response on the part of the public, the people who go to the museums? Do they have, in your view, a measurable impact on how you as a curator look at art and what gets put on display?
Well, we certainly try and anticipate what will be a popular show, but I think oftentimes what we might call a revisionist view will coincide with a popular mm-hmm. view. And that's true with Bingham, certainly, true with Remington, certainly, and there is another museum that's working on a Thomas Hart Benton show, and I'm sure it'll be true for that as well. There is also a very close relationship between museums and the latest scholarship, and that is a dialogue that is relatively new, but is is extremely healthy. As a result, museum catalogs represent some of the freshest scholarship and one of the best outlets for art historians, whether they be teaching at universities or working in museums. So by going to an exhibition, you're not only seeing an interesting sequence of works of art, you're also coming into contact with what's likely to be the cutting edge of recent scholarship.
Michael Shapiro is a curator at the St. Louis Art Museum. He's currently at work on a forthcoming study about the life and work of the mid-19th century American portrait and genre painter George Caleb Bingham. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on the History and Criticism of Art, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings would like to hear from you. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about God and the American writer. My guest will be a recent visitor at the National Humanities Center, Alfred Kazin of the City University of New York. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for a conversation about art and patronage in Renaissance Italy and an overview of contemporary art and its critics. Wayne's guests are Rona Goffin, an art historian from Duke University, and Michael Shapiro, a curator from the St. Louis Art Museum. From Bellini to Bingham, some answers and insights this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.